and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Rex Plunkett and Jeffrey Lyford from UAA's Department of Computer Networking and Office Technology on what you need to know about Wi-Fi security. Their presentation was recorded at the UAA bookstore on November 20th.
Hi there, my name is Rex Plunkett. I got my introduction to information technology in 1977 when I was part of the startup team for Atlantic Richfield side of Prudhoe Bay. I worked with the Prudhoe Bay Automation System then. So that's deep in the deep dark past. After that, you have 20-odd years of robotics projects and research and development, and then approximately 8 years ago, I became employed with University of Alaska Anchorage in the Computer and Networking Technology program. I have with me here tonight our adjunct professor, Jeffrey Lyford, who is over there. I hope you're doing video for this. Okay. Mr. Lyford is by far the expert in the field for our program at CNT. The long and the short of it is we concentrate on networking, and if the electrons can't get you, it's hard to attack you. And simple thing is we're in charge of trying our best to make sure that people who have it in for you can't deliver the attacks against you. Jeff, you have anything to say right quick? He's on there. Okay. So this is a quick overview of security in today's world. First things first, anybody here, and I'm going to say just as like the prophetic thing, anybody ever heard of the Nigerian 419 advance fee fraud? And this basically comes down to you get an email, and it's from someone. Now, my particular case, I got my email from Yasser Arafat's widow. And she offered me 10%, and she wanted to move like millions of dollars through my account, and then she'd take 90%, I'd take 10%, and we'd both be rich. But then that gets the money out of wherever it was supposed to be. Point of it is that everybody will eventually get an email like this, and it is amazing how many people actually fall for it. To this point in time, over $41 billion have been lost, and $9.3 billion in the record year, which is like 2007 or so. Current scam rate. Okay, well, current scam rate or growth rate is about, guesses anybody? How about 5% annually? And the funny thing about this is you get these emails, and this is an email scam, a simple thing, and you say, how can anybody fall for this? They have misspellings. They have claims that obviously can't be true. Well, the fact of the matter is that the people that are trying to scam you are actually fairly intelligent. What are they looking for? With all due respect, they're looking for the least intelligent portion of our population, not the smart. They don't want to solve things. They don't want to cheat the smart people. They want to cheat people that they can cheat. So the misspellings and such, to a certain extent, are even on purpose. 431 million people approximately experienced cybercrime last year. That's really a little bit of a misnomer. That was for 2010. Currently, though, we have more than a million victims a day. That's 14 a second of all sorts of cybercrime. Cybercrime being anything that costs you lost time or money having to do with computers. If you're an adult in the world today, one out of every two of you, give or take, will be a cybercrime victim. And over 400 billion lost. I mean, not a whole lot if you're a government, but quite a lot. If you're online for over 49 hours a week, what are the chances that you're a victim? 79%. And by the way, that is for the given week. what happens? How do you become part of this 79%? Well, the fact is that right now we are in the middle of the paper install revolution. Anybody is welcome to Google Symantec, S-Y-M-A-N-T-E-C, and then paper install, and you can get an excellent white paper on this. Paper install is the funnest thing you could ever do. Basically, you have deniability at all levels. At the very top, you have a boss. The boss just says, I will pay you as a human being, and all you have to do is bring up a server with a web page and deliver out free software to people. You talk them into downloading the software, and typically they are Trojan horses. That is, they have to be invited in by the user. And typically, just like a Trojan horse, they have a payload that's obvious and a payload that is hidden. It's the hidden payload that makes money. So sure enough, you install this Trojan horse with its payload, and some period of time goes off, and a pop-up appears on your screen saying you have a virus or something, or they scramble your machine, or. But the long and the short of it is you say something's wrong here. So what do? We go to Google or some other search engine. We get on the web. We get to this help group, and there are posts in this help group of other people that have exactly the same problem as we did. And you look, and someone says, well, I fixed this because I went to this other website over here and downloaded this package, and it cleaned it right up. Well, guess what? The same person who paid to get the software installed on your machine is also paying for people to post solutions on these solution-based public forums, this sort of thing. What happens? You go to the site, you look at this, and there's this thing you can download for free. You download it for free, and it says, hey, we found the Trojan horse that you have. We can fix it. Unfortunately, this is the bare bones package. It doesn't fix the current version of it. You're on version 17.4, and we only fix up to version 15.5. But if you send us $29.95, we fix it. Well, you're desperate to get your machine up and running. You pay $29.95. Congratulations, the scammers just made $29.95 off of you. They send you the package. The package does clear up the Trojan horse. After all, they put it in. Another branch of their same organization now is taking it out. Oh, but did we mention that the same program that takes it out can decide that it's going to plant yet another Trojan horse in your machine? So you get to play this whole game again and again and again. Well, the whole point of this is, think about it. It's not necessary. At the very top, we fed you an internet-based application. You ask for it. We just gave it to you for free. And it put something that was mean and nasty into your machine. Oh, I didn't know that happened from my website. Or I close the website down every 2 weeks and just bring it back up under a different name. So then, I'm really sorry I gave you a Trojan horse. I didn't take any of your money, though. I didn't steal anything from you. Next thing, and since I am located outside of the borders of the United States, you do have to get international law enforcement involved to even find me and prosecute me. Next thing is that help, the blog that describes how to fix this problem, it was just human beings posting. So that person just says, I just posted a solution. Sorry about that. I didn't do anything wrong. And then the person that sold you the solution says, oh, gosh, my solution worked. What's the problem? I sold you something for $29.95. It worked. We're happy guys. And then the next person, that same $29.95 person says, well, we didn't know that there was something that invaded our software. Maybe you could find a way to get some part of your money back from that. And maybe not. Long and the short of it is, this is the paper install scam, and it can be as many levels or layers deep as you need it to be. And the people involved, except for the connection to the top, they don't know each other at all. Okay, now that is like the quick introduction of cybercrime today. What we're going to talk about, though, is specifically wireless and security for your wireless. We're talking about wireless today. All the things you wanted to know about wireless, didn't have a chance to ask or didn't even know you wanted to ask. And yes, we've already talked about 431 million adults so far. We'll get into Gordon Moore if I have slack time in between Mr. Lyford breaking all of our wireless. We talked about pay-per-install. Now we're talking about your Wi-Fi. Do they all interrelate? Yep. They all have to do with moving electrons, moving signal through the air, and who can get it from you, and who can insinuate things into your. If you buy a wireless access point or a wireless router, typically it's going to have some number of different channels that allow it to broadcast and send and receive data over ether, over the air. Wireless in is the current state of the art in wireless, but there are earlier versions that are A, B, and G. All wireless, for the most part, is working either on the 5 gigahertz or the 2.4 gigahertz wavelength bands. With wireless, there are four major authentication and protection models. If you just put your signal out into the air and let anybody come in, then yes, then those people are in your network and can do anything they want to try and exploit your network. Favorite things to exploit your network? Well, gosh, I'm just going to go on and download movies and movies and movies and movies, and eventually you get to the limit of your account, and then you end up being damaged by having to pay overage fees for me downloading movies. So that can be my simple goal. I just don't want to pay for wireless, so I borrow from my neighbor, so to speak. The four authentication protection methods are WEP, called Wired Equivalent Privacy. It's thoroughly broken. WPA, Wi-Fi Protected Access, with WPA2. Those variations are exploitable, but actually not broken at this time. Wi-Fi Protected Setup, which is absolutely and completely broken. Not only is it broken, once you break it once, if you change the password on that particular device, it's still broken. I don't have to do anything after the first time. The Wi-Fi protected access device will give up the goods to us. And then finally, some type of internal network authentication, which is what UAA uses on our wireless network, where the actual access point does not authenticate you, it leads to authentication inside of the UAA network. Sorry about that. Number four is not built into most wireless access points. So let's start with WEP. We have a router up here with WEP on it, and the WEP router has exactly nothing connected but power. All I have, so I'm not getting into UAA's network, okay? All that's connected here is power. All that we're going to try and do today is break it. And to break it, I'm not interacting with that at all. No one's logged into it. It has a password. Mr. Lyford, you're welcome to start trying to break it. I'm sure that I'll have plenty of time to talk while you're doing this. So he's not touched it. We have a password on it that's medium good. Trouble with WEP is you have 10 or 26 hexadecimal character keys, and they are breakable in almost no time at all with correct equipment. And yes, you can download the programs to do it from the internet if you have the type of laptop or desktop computer that they'll run on. Amount of skill needed by you? Well, you have to be willing to spend some time studying and learning the methods, but not a lot of skill necessary.
Is there a charge?
Oh, no, it's free. Oh, I'm certainly not going to charge. I mean, I'm going to pay money to break you. I'm just going to break you. The whole thing is that you drive around Anchorage and you look at wireless access points that are up in the neighborhoods all over town, you're going to find out that a lot of them, and I would just say probably even as much as a third of them, this is known broken, been known broken for 5 years, but they have it because it's really easy. It's the top option in that, and all they have to do is type in like some little 10-digit seed for either the 10 or 26 character built-in key, and they're done. Quick and easy, and I've got a secure network now. Well, the trouble is that, yes, I have a secure network now, but it's so thoroughly broken that anybody who's interested, and in this case, I don't even have anybody on that router. all we're doing right now is Mr. Lyford is, first off, getting a session going so he can introduce bad things to the router, talk to the router answering back, and eventually the router will give up the goods for him. So did that answer your question? What percentage? Can't tell you. It'll vary over time. As a percentage overall, probably yes, it's shrinking because other options are out there. But I would say easily a third. Simple WEP, probably as much as 10%. No security at all. Just, hi, I'm a wireless network. You want to join? You're in. When we get into the land of WPA and WPA2, here the actual algorithm has not been broken. But now we get into a different type of attack that can happen, and that is the attack not on the actual encryption or handshaking itself, but the attack on the passwords we use. With WPA2, once I manage to capture a handshake packet, I can quit right there, take that packet home with me, and run on some fairly sophisticated equipment, but again, with free programs, and eventually break a short password. Short password in this case, say you decide to set up a WPA and your password is only 10, 12 characters long. And I'm going to say, if it's 10 characters long and it's a password, the chances of us finding it in one of the password files that we've run into by this point, pretty good. Okay, now Mr. Lyford is now going to turn his attentions to WPA2. In this case, different technique. The technique is to capture a packet, and then, yes, he's running against a set of passwords. Let's talk about passwords. This is way fun. Substituting special characters for letters, using upper and lowercase letters, using keyboard patterns on your keyboards. The fact of the matter is that lots of people use these kind of techniques, and sure enough, the people who are inventing or working with the password cracking type programs, they recognize this and they build it in. If you use any kind of modern slang, or by the way, if you use the word sex in your password, chances are your password is also on someone's password list, if you will. Now, the method they're using for breaking these passwords basically comes down to they run against good computer equipment over a long period of time. And then what they do is they break and break and break various password letter and number combinations that could be passwords. So if I decide to substitute the number 1 for every I in my name, not going to help. They check for I's every time they check for 1's, or 1's every time they check for I's. If I decide to use 3's for E's, doesn't work. If I decide to go up and down my keyboard and type in, for instance, 2WSX, which is a diagonal line across my keyboard, chances are they have that. So upper and lowercase substitutions don't really help at all. One thing we did say is we said short password. As your password length increases, then your security increases. And if you're willing to carry around and use a password for WPA that is, say, 20 characters or long, you actually are presenting a significant deterrent to someone breaking that password. And, yes, that's part of Jeff's presentation here. What? Well, yes, it's a lot of length. I mean, but on the other hand, 10 characters, literally there are people out there now that have all of the 10-character upper and lowercase numbers, special characters, passwords. They have them broken. They're in a database. You can pay a fee, send them a packet, and they will tell you, yep, there's the password for it. And the fact of it is comes down to this. Letters A through Z, 26 possibilities, right? Everybody happy with that? So if I have a 2-letter password, how many combinations with just lowercase letters? 26 squared, the first times the second, right? Now, I add numbers, 0 through 9. Now there's 36. Now a 2-letter password, 36 squared. You see where we're coming from here? I include upper, lowercase, that's 52 letters, 10 characters worth of numbers, and then, say, 15 characters worth of special characters. You see how, yes, the numbers get bigger and bigger and bigger. One thing that we do have here is Jeff and I, or I should say, Mr. Jeff Lyford captured a 34 gigabyte password comparison table. Now, that password comparison table contains millions and millions of the most commonly identified used passwords to allow you to do searches against them. So, yes, we're talking about vast numbers, but we're also talking about I can let my computer run nights, weekends, and holidays for a month. It doesn't matter to me. And eventually, yes, passwords that are short, good chance of being broken. Number of characters in the 5 to 10 is short, okay? Over 20, you're starting to approach being practically safe. Okay, back to WEP real quick for a second. One thing on WEP is, yes, you can force WEP to give up more and more packets to you by interrupting the flow of signal, which means that that's one way that you get a greater and greater sample of what they're sending, making it easier and easier for them to break you. As long as we're talking about this, let's step out for a second. I promise to come back to the other nasty things that can happen to us. But let's step outside the box for just a second and have a look at computer advances. This is a real short slideshow, and it's about Gordon Moore's law. Gordon Moore was a computer science, one of the founders of Intel. In 1947, sure enough, William Shockley, Britton, and Breeden successfully created the first transistor. In 1954, we had the first silicone-based transistor, and a semiconductor revolution started. In 1965, Dr. Moore made a fairly bold prediction, and he said, this is known as Moore's Law, that the number of transistors on a chip will double approximately every 2 years. His actual statement was, based on evidence from 1958 to 1965, this had happened and would continue to happen for another 10 years. Transistors, if you're actually measuring computing power, number of transistors on a chip is the closest thing to an absolute number that you can measure, powerful versus less powerful. Sure enough, Gordon Moore predicted it in 65. Through 2007, it still held true. But in 2005, Gordon Moore was interviewed, and he said eventually the law has to fall. And the reason he says it has to fall is because eventually we're going to get down to atom-level computing. Mr. Lyford, you just ruined the middle of my speech. Go for it.
Okay, so 53 seconds of computation to break that WPA password. For those of you that are interested, it is exclamation point, pound sign, lowercase u, damn, uppercase hacker, pound sign, exclamation point. So not a random word in the dictionary, actually a combination of words and symbols. The key to cracking WPA is the password must be in the dictionary. If it is in the word list, there's a 100% probability of key recovery. If it's not in the word list, there's a 0% chance of key recovery. However, as Rex was mentioning, the word lists are getting pretty ridiculous. And for those of you who remembers the SETI at home project, where you download a screensaver and SETI sends you some data to scramble on and try to find ET and the aliens, there's a similar program on the internet now in the hacking community where they're working to generate every potential password combination from 4 characters to 25 characters. Been running for a couple of years, and they're at, like, I think 17 or 18 characters. They've completed every possible combination from 4 to 17 characters. Every possible legal combination of A, B, 1, 0, exclamation point, period, special characters, spaces, etc. But so results may vary. This was 53 seconds to find that password in a dictionary that contains 14.5 million passwords. That 38 gig dictionary he talked about earlier contains 4.5 billion eligible passphrases. And it's one of those, you know, if I have days to work on it, I have days to work on it. This particular machine is not a beast of a machine. It'll run through 4.5 billion passwords in about 16 days. I have another machine at home that'll run through the same amount of passwords in about 4 days. And there's a service online that I can pay $17 a month that can do the same thing in 10 hours. And they have a vastly superior dictionary file to what I have.
Okay. The third method of Wi-Fi protection is built into many routers these days. It's called Wi-Fi protected setup. It's actually, initially it was built to make it easy to connect wireless printers and this sort of things to your network. The good news is it has the same general password scheme as WPA. Long passwords, really pretty secure. But the bad news is they use a eight numeral key, and that key is keyed or is identified with the actual device that's using Wi-Fi protected setup. So once you break that eight digit key, you own the device. Someone changes the password, the device will give it right back up to you. So, Jeff, you want to give us the quick rundown on breaking Wi-Fi protected setup? Go. He's bumbling now.
We're actually waiting for this to authenticate. Oh, there it goes. So what was that, about 8 seconds, 9 seconds? And it's broken. And when you log into it, you change the password. And I can't log into it anymore. I just break it 9 more seconds. Unfortunately, it's a good idea. We want people to use long, complicated passwords. We want people's encryption algorithms to be secure because a lot of what goes on with encrypted wireless traffic is people sit around and they'll snoop traffic. It's not actually, you know, I want to sit in your network and download movies from Netflix. I want to sit in your network and listen to everything you do. I have to have that key to decrypt all the packets that you exchange with your router so I actually know what's going on. This unfortunately compromises WPA to an unbelievably low extent. And the problem is, and this is kind of fake, 9 seconds is, I won't say staged, but it's fairly staged, because the process can actually take anywhere from a couple of minutes to multiple days. Unlike WEP, where we're mathematically breaking the encryption, so WEP is 100% breakable. The technology used to implement the encryption is so inferior that a computer can outmath the encryption. WPA, the strength of it resolves in your password. So if you have a strong password, it takes longer and it's harder to get into it. WPS, we're again exploiting the length of the key. So where WEP, I can crack it and it's done in a couple of minutes. WPA can take anywhere from a couple of minutes to multiple days to years. If I was going to generate every possible computation for a 15-character password on a very, very high-end desktop computer, it would take something like 400 eons from my one computer to generate every possible password combination from 4 characters to 15 characters. Distributed, obviously, that doesn't take any time at all, which is why the online services have made their way to where they are. Wi-Fi protected setup, on the other hand, is 8 characters, and it takes, I want to say something like probably 10 to 12 days to exhaust the potentials. Unlike WPA, where I can try, in this case, I was doing 12,000 passwords per second to try to break the handshake. With WPS, it's 1 or 2 a minute. So I turn it on and I let it go, and I come back in a week. I go on vacation to Hawaii. When I come back, you might be broken, or it might be a couple more days, but eventually it's going to break. WPS will always give up the goods. The bad news is I break WPA, you change your password, I got to do it all over again. I break WPS. If you don't turn it off, I'm right back in. Because once I have it, it is 9 seconds to break it again.
Now, unfortunately, the fourth method of authenticating or protecting your wireless network is not generally available to the public, but that involves having a handshake, but then doing your authentication and generating your encryption for your signal inside of your network with a server that requires a safe handshake, a safe encrypted password sent that is generally keyed on something that is constantly changing so that, no, you can't target the same static password again and again and again. And then you authenticate inside your network. Yes, you're in that day. If you break that day, that's great. You're not going to be breaking with the same thing the next day. When we start looking at the sum total of this, the sum total is if you own a XYZ brand, $49.95, $109.95, it does not matter, wireless access point. Do not even consider WEP. If you possibly can, turn off Wi-Fi protected setup or buy one that does not have it. And if you're going to use WPA2, know very certainly that any password or passphrase of 10 characters or less, if it's not broken now, it will be broken relatively soon. Best is to go over 20. When you get to over 20, yes, Jeff did allude to the project that's supposed to be breaking everything between 4 and 25 characters, but the fact is that every time you add another character to it, you're adding the total possible number of characters that can be in any one value or any one position. You extend that out 25 positions, then it's, you know, 59 to the 25th power. Takes a lot longer to hash out and to attack that and actually fit or beat every password. If you have a Wi-Fi, if you have Wi-Fi and you're on WEP, get rid of it. If you're on Wi-Fi and you're using WPA, get a long password. If you have Wi-Fi and it's using Wi-Fi protected setup, turn it off. Now, the one last thing that we're going to touch on, and then we're done for the day quickly, except for questions. The last thing we're going to touch on is a quick little, I'm going to say not quite exercise, but a quick little illustration of password things. If you're doing a password and you have a password, let's say it's based on a dictionary word, state of Alaska. Alaska, everybody got that? It's on every password list known to man probably as far as being broken. If I'm building my password, substituting the digit 1 for the L in Alaska, not going to help. Because there are programs out there that literally look at the word and then say every variation of letters, the characters that could substitute for letters, they're going to solve for that. However, substituting for letters, bad thing. Inserting characters, good thing. How can I make Alaska a much stronger password? How about we go this way? I'm going to say Alaska, ALA1234SKA. Now, not only is it 10 characters long, there is no consecutive dictionary word in this mess. That's the way to make your passwords much stronger, much more easily. If you really want to, yes, you can do all sorts of things. Suggestions basically is something you remember and then add characters where you can. You know what characters you're adding. You can add whatever again and again and again just to make it longer and longer and longer. Now, here is fair warning. Repeated characters can be more easily recognized by some of the programs than non-repeated characters. So, no, it does not do you any good to say ALA and then you put in 35 ones and then SKA. The fact is that in the pattern of the password, maybe the program can recognize the 35 ones and figure out, oh, yes, if I have a number of the same thing in a row, I can solve for that much more easily than if I have a number of kind of random things. If you're going to be adding characters in things, great. Add 1234, not 1111. because then each character that added is a different character. And yes, you can mix the upper and lower case. That's what's going to make your password stronger. So dictionary word, don't keep it in a row. Split it apart. Pad with other characters. Yes, if you really want to, you can pad with other dictionary words. Long and short of it is, if you have a word and you're saying the word straight out, and that word's in the dictionary and it's part of your password, probably it's in Jeff's, what, 5 billion password dictionary. Thank you very much. Jeff, thank you. You are the one that actually did all the real work here. All I did was talk. Someone had to fill in, like, the blank space in between him doing the stuff.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Rex Plunkett and his hacker assistant, Jeffrey Lyford, both adjunct professors in the Department of Computer Networking and Office Technology at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Their presentation on What You Need to Know About Wi-Fi Security was recorded at the UAA bookstore on November 20th. Following their presentation, both Rex and Jeff responded to questions from the audience. First, they were asked, is Gordon Moore still alive?
As far as I know, Gordon Moore is indeed still alive. And the fact of it is that in the time period since he made his prediction, quick thing, way back in the early 21st century, 2002 or so, we had 90 nanometer silicone wafers. Everybody happy with this? That's what we made chips out of. 3-4 years ago, it was down to 45. This year, 2012, they opened 5 22 nanometer fabricators for silicone wafers in the United States. To give everybody a little bit of a hint on how close we are to atomic level computing, a sugar molecule, a simple sugar molecule, is like 12 nanometers in thickness. So we're down to the point where, no, we're not down to atom size yet, but we are definitely down to very small molecule size. And eventually, yes, we're not going to be able to squeeze things anymore, and then the doubling every 2 years is going to come to a halt.
The next question from the audience was, what's your experience with the various antivirus programs?
Okay, the simplest thing about antivirus programs is whenever a new virus comes out, the first day it comes out and attacks people, obviously there's no solution to it. This is what is known as a zero-day attack. That's what you truly fear. Your antivirus programs, the major brands, they're all good, okay? But the fact of the matter is that your antivirus is as good as your updates. That's the key to this thing. If you're a student at University of Alaska Anchorage, IT services will even, it's in on the UAA website, or you can call IT services. They will actually give you a copy of an enterprise level antivirus program that's very excellent, and that's just for being a student at the U. But as far as what's good, what's bad, any one brand of antivirus beats some viruses, doesn't beat other ones.
Is it true that you can only run one antivirus program at a time?
Yes, they quite often conflict, and quite often they do cause, they don't want to run together because each one will recognize the other one's actions as something being an attack on your machine.
What about spybot programs and malware bytes?
Spybot programs are things that look at things coming into your computer from the internet. And for the most part, at this point in time, there is such a vast array of things that can come in from the internet to your machine that I've quit running spybots. The ancient spybot search and destroy, wonderful thing, worked for years and years. I discarded it 4 years ago and have had no negative effects. Malwarebytes is an excellent item. Now, the one thing about it is it's good as a tool that allows you to look at what's going on inside your machine. As a tool, it's very excellent. As far as leaving it running all the time, no.
Next, another audience member asked Mr. Plunkett, what programs do you recommend putting on your computer?
A strong operating system that you go out for updates when it happens. Okay. a strong antivirus program that you allow to update as often as it can. And then for the key software that you like to run, get the updates for those pieces of software when they come out. Examples are things like if you were running your own website, there's a program named Apache that's been around for years and years on the X operating systems and also on, also now it's ported to Windows. Long and short of it is, if you have a version of Apache that's 8 years old, someone's probably found exploits to that program. If you don't have a patched version of Apache for your website, you're vulnerable. You can be broken. So when I say, what do I put on my machine? I run a very plain Jane machine. If I'm running a Windows operating system, I run that. I run antivirus, and I'm careful about staying up on updates.
Another audience member asked, what programs does the University of Alaska Anchorage provide for its students and faculty?
They're using Symantec Enterprise Protection, or SEP. And as far as I can tell, it does very well. The other thing, I'm sorry. In answer to your question, by the way, backups. Windows 7 has a built-in backup program which will allow you to back up to an external hard drive. If you do that once a week, for instance, and something nasty and terrible does happen to your machine, you can turn back the clock a week. And that's a better protection than all the things you can buy in a world.
Please discuss storing media in the cloud.
Cloud computing is its own animal. We're just going to come right out and say the following thing. You put something up on the cloud, you have the promise of someone that it's well protected and up there. Unfortunately, you don't know where it actually exists in machinery. And it could very well be that a portion of what's stored that's yours on the cloud could be stored in a country that has very lax laws about allowing the people that are storing it to examine your data. I alluded to this way earlier. If you have to cross an international border to prosecute someone who's doing bad things to your machinery or bad things to your data, now all of a sudden you have to get two law enforcement agencies involved. And if the no-goodniks have skipped through and used some kind of technology that is relatively straightforward called proxy servers to make it so the signal goes through three or four countries before it lands at the other end of the rainbow, so to speak, now all of a sudden you may end up with law enforcement organizations from three or four different countries that would have to be involved to prosecute a person who did you ill.
In many cases with Canada
is actually not one of the nicest places in the world. They actually have a fairly high incidence of being a place where attacks originate from. The U.S. is at least a place where you have law enforcement local that works for us. This semester, fall semester 2012, the security class in the Computer and Networking Technology Department, we put up four unprotected web servers that also had the ability to sign into them on a public IP address, and sure enough, within hours, all four were attacked. From China and other countries, by the way. Well, you can trace the source IP address or the source address on the internet to the place where, in theory, it came from. And yes, we did that, and we looked up the countries involved. And yes, we got attacked real quick.
Another audience member wondered, who are the top offenders for internet hacking?
Top offenders in our case this semester included Indonesia, China, included Pakistan, and actually, if I recall right, Korea and Russia were not on the list this semester. But I want to qualify this really quickly. No, I did not allow our students to leave their machines up too terribly long because, of course, we didn't want to lose that particular battle either.
The next audience question, is government hacking a pretty big concern?
As far as security goes, the best hope that I can have as an individual is that I can make a network that I'm protecting strong enough to withstand attack by a non-government entity. The government of any country can buy if they really want to, hundreds of thousands of computers. You see where I'm coming from? And use those, if nothing else, just to deliver packet attacks on me, where all they're doing is just using up bandwidth for me.
Just for some perspective, I believe it was 2008 when Russia invaded Georgia. 2008, Russia shut down the country of Georgia electronically leading up to that. Completely shut them down. And that was 2008. So how far has technology come in 4 years? They were unable to communicate. So that includes knocking them off the internet, shutting down all their websites, taking down their mail servers, jamming high frequency radio communications, a complete communications blackout. Short of the actual dedicated landline where I run a cable from my house to your house and we put phones on the end and there's no one in between, everything that was infrastructure was effectively shut down. But no, if you really, really want to have secure, nobody can mess with it, it put two coffee cans and a string between your house and your neighbor. I cannot hack that.
But he can cut the string.
The next hand to rise in the audience wondered, since so many younger people are dependent on these devices, do you think we're in more trouble?
No, I'm a technologist. I think exactly the opposite. The long and the short of this is, yes, all sorts of bad things come out of things. But if you fear the future, then what do you have? I mean, we can all go back to farming. But, I mean, no, I'm a big fan of technology. And the fact of it is that if you take steps to make it difficult, then you're relatively safe and straightforward. Okay? Last slide. Just wanted to give you everybody a quick little, this is a way of comparing technology yesterday and today as far as Gordon Moore's law. If you looked in 1970 and you considered, in this case we're considering transistors to be people. In 1970 you could fit in the West High Auditorium or an auditorium about twice the size of the Wendy Williamson Auditorium. You could fit approximately 2,300 people or the equivalent of 2,300 transistors. By the time we get to 1988, we could fit 134,000 people into the Windy or West High Auditorium. We keep moving by the year 2000. We're in the millions, probably in the 18, 19 million people range in the West High Auditorium. And today, if you wanted to, you could basically seat the whole, I'm sorry, you could probably stuff the whole population of China into the West High Auditorium. So that is telling you how much computing power is getting packed into one enclosed small area. That's how things have expanded. And take care of your own security, work on those things you can control, and don't worry about the things you can't. Get good backups.
One more for you to consider. What do you suppose the probability is that the majority of your either household appliances or basic functions in your house, lighting, alarm systems, et cetera, will be completely online in the next 10 years? Seem like a fairly fair assumption. In a past life, I worked for the Department of Defense. One of our fears was I believe it was a 2004 technology demonstration where a hacker destroyed a generator remotely. Because if you think, that makes sense, right? I put the generator online, the controls for the generator. I put it online so I don't have to be there to manage it. I can log into it from my house. Or you have one guy to manage 100 generators and he just has to monitor them and respond accordingly, right? Well, because it was online, they were able to physically destroy the generator by hacking into the control. Just kind of something to think about when you think about why is it important? Why do I care? I don't do Netflix. I don't shop on Amazon. I don't put my information online. I watch YouTube and that's it. Well, eventually all your stuff's going to be online. This is why this is important. Because that was 2006.
Can we use biometrics to keep people from breaking in with passwords?
There's actually an effort to do that right now.
We see it in James Bond movies all the time.
There's an effort to do that right now. What they are working on is a combination of, like, if you're going to log into your email, say, you have to have, we kind of have it now, but it's not biometrics, but eventually it will be. You have to have a password and your fingerprint to log into your email.
What about your retina scanner?
That's a potential, too. The retina scanner is a lot more expensive than the fingerprint scanner. Well, and there are changes that can be made to the eye because, I mean, it's just like a fingerprint. A fingerprint can be altered, too. Everybody saw Gone in 60 Seconds? Congratulations, you're now Elvis. Little sticky jelly things on his fingers. It really depends. I mean, there's a technology similar to that built into my laptop right now where it will only accept my login if I stand in front of the webcam and it recognizes my face.
Yeah, that's funny. The facial recognition or
sound. So if I get into a horrible fire, I can't log into my laptop anymore. It's there. There are technologies out there to do that. There are things that will take your fingerprint and seed it as part of a password. So your password is not actually your password. It is the combination of the password and a fingerprint. We call that two-factor authentication. There are other ways to do it. Anybody here game? Play any online games? Okay. Has anybody heard about the major commercial undertaking for a game called World of Warcraft, where people sell their accounts for thousands of dollars? One of the efforts that Blizzard, the parent company, has undertaken is, in addition to your password to log into your account, you also have to use a mobile authenticator that runs on your phone. So you open up an app on your phone, it generates a number based on what time it is, and you need that password and that number. So in order to get into somebody's World of Warcraft account, you have to have their password and you have to steal their phone, which is a lot more secure than just stealing their password. Because right now, you get your password stolen because you use it. The same password you use for your World of Warcraft account is also the password you used for your unencrypted mail service, and you were at Starbucks checking your mail, and I got a hold of your email account, and I found the receipt from Blizzard, and I got a hold of your WoW account. Suddenly, I just made maybe a couple $1,000s. But now I actually have to compromise your phone, too, which adds a layer of security. They're doing the same thing with retina scans and fingerprints and everything else. When I worked for DOD, we had a series where you actually had a badge, which was a radio frequency chip, and your fingerprint to go through a door. So you got to steal my badge and cut my finger off.
Are there any international groups looking at global security?
NATO is a big driver of the defense industry's efforts at security. And a lot of, if you think about it, the internet came from DOD.
Yeah.
NATO drives a lot of that. Primarily that's driven by the U.S., but there are some other participants and things like that. Europe is actually a big place for the study of cryptography. And some of the techniques and stuff we talked about today actually originated with researchers at universities in Europe.
The last audience question was, what kind of laws do we need to protect our online security?
That's a good question. I don't think there is a lawyer in the world qualified to answer that question. I don't know that I believe it's a legal problem. It is a person problem. Because as long as people use weak passwords, it doesn't matter. I mean, for instance, you can make it illegal to own a gun, and then only criminals will have guns. You can make it illegal to have weak passwords, and only victims will have weak passwords. It's a thing we have to educate and change from the user's perspective. It's not necessarily something I believe that can be legislated. Yes, this is a big step. When you see how easy it is, make you rethink your password when you go home and, put in Fluffy as your password, or I love ice cream. By the way, that's in my dictionary.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Rex Plunkett and Jeffrey Lyford, both adjunct professors in the Department of Computer Networking and Office Technology at the University of Alaska Anchorage. They responded to questions from the audience following their presentation on what you need to know about Wi-Fi security. This event was hosted and recorded by the UAA Bookstore on November 20th, 2012. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskan's theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.